If you want to learn more about the topics of today's episode, visit the podcast website at naturesecretservice.com. Thanks for listening. Okay, people, listen up. Here we go. This is Nature's Secret Service, the podcast that puts you in the room with the men and women of wildlife law enforcement. I'm Ed Newcomer, your host, and today we have a short bonus episode with one of our prior guests, Special Agent Sean Mann, formerly with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, recently retired. Sean, thanks for being back on the show for this short bonus episode. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, good to be here, Ed.
Fantastic. Hey, you and I, we both worked in the same region. We worked in Region 1, which eventually became Region 8, but essentially the west coast of California. And we both worked in California for a while. And one of the things we've talked about on this show before, Sean, and you and I talked about many times in our career, were, you know, the difficulties associated with doing habitat investigations where somebody, usually a landowner, has destroyed habitat where an endangered species lives, and that would actually be considered take under the Endangered Species Act. But one of the difficult things about these investigations, as you know, and you and I have discussed, is the best way to make that case that somebody has taken an endangered species by damaging habitat is to get out there and try to find a body, right? And you and I and other agents have spent many times out in the field kind of looking for a dead endangered species to try to help make a habitat destruction case all the better. And you, there's a lot of these cases happen in California because there's a lot of endangered species in California, and land is very valuable, and people sometimes want to develop land that they shouldn't. Or they don't go through the right processes in order to be legally allowed to do that. And Sean, you have an experience on one of these habitat investigation cases that, honestly, it didn't happen to me, but it keeps me up at night when I think about what happened to you on this case. Tell us a little bit about it. What was the nature of the investigation? Was it, I can't remember if it involved California salamanders, or what was the species you were looking at?
Vernal pool, fairy shrimp.
Okay. You were working on a fairy shrimp case. I've worked on those too, and talk about difficult to find a body, right? Cause you're talking about tiny little shrimp. So you were out conducting an investigation to document destruction of habitat where fairy shrimp were known to occur, and fairy shrimp are endangered species.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and see what made our case good in the sense of we were talking about, this was an area of designated critical habitat.
Oh, it had already been pre-designated.
Right.
Got it.
Unique in the sense that it was private ownership, but the landowner had already received a cease and desist.
Okay.
Which was different in a lot of the cases we were handling civilly. We were dealing a lot with construction areas where they would settle those cases pretty fast. And we worked with a lot of good biologists that would write good biological take statements where we didn't necessarily need a body.
I see.
If where they could determine based on breeding, feeding, or sheltering, if they were significantly impacted, and they would stand behind that biological take statement or biological assessment based on the impact to the habitat destruction. And they would write very good assessments that we didn't need dead bodies, because in a lot of these instances, you weren't going to find a dead body, especially on a species that you can't even see with the naked eye.
Yeah, right. It's tiny little, barely see it on the tip of your finger. Why did you, at some point though, you go out in the field to work on this investigation? What took you out into the field that caused this incident you're about to tell us about?
So another agent had been looking into this, and she had been out with a biologist on another piece of the property. This landowner was president of the California Farming Association.
Okay.
So he was very politically connected. Mm. So it was very, he was challenging the Endangered Species Act was what he was doing.
Right.
So despite the cease and desist letters he was getting from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, he was trying to push this into a very political agenda.
So he continued to make changes to the habitat.
Yeah. And so one of our informants who lived in and around the area could see that he was starting to top disc one of his fields, which is what you would do before you start to deep rip.
I see.
And so if you disc the top of an area, that's not necessarily habitat destruction. When you start to deep rip the area, like a deep rip your field, that's right. Habitat destruction.
Right.
So he could see that he was top disking the field, which meant he was getting ready to deep rip it.
So basically he's going to take out those vernal pools basically.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
So, and the best way to explain why vernal pools are so important, imagine that migratory birds, as they're flying south for the winter, that's like a truck stop
right.
for them on their way south. So yeah. They see the vernal pools and they can lay dormant for years.
Right.
But as soon as they fill up with water, birds can fly down and they feed on the vernal pool, fairy shrimp. And then they get back up in the air and they fly. So it acts as like a flying J
right.
or a love truck stop if you're on the interstate, you
right.
know, just the same for migratory birds. It's what they are.
And you know? Vernal pools, so everybody knows it's not like a lake that's there all the time. It's just kind of a depression in the earth that during rainy season will usually fill up, but not always. Sometimes
yeah.
if it's a dry season, they won't fill up. But when they do, they become home to a lot of species, including fairy shrimp, but also California yeah. tiger salamanders, which are endangered species. And then, like yeah. you said, they're a stopover for other species that rely on those potential food and water sources that are there during critical times of the year. So that's right. why vernal pools, that's what a vernal pool is, and that's why vernal pools are important to wildlife. So
right.
you went out there to what? Just document that this person had been making habitat changes?
Yeah. So I was going to put a GPS unit in my pocket, and I was basically just going to walk mm-hmm. the area that he was disking.
Okay.
You know, so we could put it on a map is all.
And you're so entitled to be there because this is what's called open fields in federal case law.
Yep.
It's not it's not a dwelling. It's not anywhere somebody would have a reasonable expectation of privacy. It's even though it's private land, it is open field. And so you could walk around on it.
Yeah. U.S. versus Oliver circa 84, which is what gave us the open fields doctrine.
Yeah. To do specifically though, you got to be there on official business to do an official investigations.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
So the closest curtilage was his house, maybe half a mile down the road.
Right. Okay. So you're out there. What happens while you're out there doing this survey?
So I was at my government vehicle with the informant, and the informant says Watkins just drove by. Who was the subject of the investigation?
Guy named Watkins. Okay.
Watkins. So I had never seen Watkins, didn't know what he looked like. So I said, you better get going then. Casey shows up and I said, he knows you're the informant, right? Or he's working with us. And he said, yeah, he knows. And I said, okay, well, I said, not that your cover's blown or at all, you know, but I said, you better get out of here anyway.
Right.
And he says, okay, fair enough. So I had to walk down maybe, you know, 50 yards to where there was a depression underneath the barbed wire fence.
Uh-huh.
Cause the barbed wire was like every 8 inches or so. Not enough for me to pull it open and then try to get in between. And it was pretty high. It was maybe 5 feet high.
Okay.
So I'm not getting over the top of it or, you know, but there was a depression that I could crawl underneath of it, about 50 yards down. So I get underneath the fence and I start walking along the fence line. And then right about actually kind of where my truck was is where the disking kind of went off into a slanted direction away from the fence line. So I get probably, well, as the GPS unit told me later, it's probably about 60, 70 yards away from the fence line. And I start hearing this horn honking.
Okay.
You know, and I turn around and I see it's a truck and it's honking at me. And I take another couple steps and I turn around again and I get out, I turn around and I see a fairly big guy, you know, standing outside the truck. And I remember looking down at my watch and then taking out, I had a notepad in my hand and I'm thinking, this is probably the landowner.
Right.
And, I remember noting the time and then saying, cause this is probably going to go in a report.
Right.
And then, right about that time, and it happened all so fast, you know, he walked out from the truck and he locks and loads a gun. He kind of pulls it out to the side and then he puts it right at me.
A pistol. Oh boy.
And being a firearms instructor and some, you know, obviously a law enforcement officer and somebody familiar with weapons.
Right.
You know, I mean, when you pull a slide to the rear.
Yeah.
With a magazine in it. If there was no ammo in it, then that slide would have locked.
Yeah.
But he locked and loaded it.
Yeah.
He locked and loaded around.
Charging a gun will get your attention, especially if you're in law enforcement. Yep.
Right.
So
he points it at me and he starts screaming out at me to, you know, what the F am I doing? And start yelling obscenities at me. And I start thinking, rats, you know, what do I do? You know? And,
so what are you wearing? Like what are you wearing at this? Like, what do you have anything on?
I had a hat on with a badge.
Okay.
But otherwise I wasn't wearing, I mean, I had a belt badge on.
Okay.
And I had a hat on that had, you know, a badge on it. But otherwise I was wearing a polo shirt, you know, and jeans.
Okay.
And, you know, and I had my gun on, you know, all my LE gear on my belt and whatnot.
Right.
And I couldn't get my belt badge off my belt.
Okay.
It was on there too tight. So I remember going for my credentials in my back pocket. And I remember holding my badge over my head saying, I'm a federal agent, get your gun off me.
Yep.
And he wouldn't take his gun off me. And so what seemed like an eternity, was probably only a few seconds. I remember I got to do something, you know,
right.
I mean, I was afraid of him pulling the trigger or starting to shoot. So I remember he had a big camper shell on the back of his truck. I remember walking in a diagonal direction and thinking, if I walk far enough, he's going to have to walk to the back of his truck to see me.
Nice.
And that's exactly what happened. I felt a little bit more in control of the situation at that point in time. So he walked to the back of the truck and he still had the gun on me.
Okay.
And I had my badge out and I kept saying to him, I'm a federal agent, you know, take your gun off, you know, quit pointing the gun at me. So, but as soon as he got to the back of the truck, I cut back over. Now I'm walking towards the front of his truck.
Smart.
So then he walks to the front of his truck. And then as soon as he got to the front of his truck, points his gun at me again.
Oh boy.
So then I cut back over and I start walking towards the back of the truck and I zigzag all the way till now I'm about probably 5 feet in front of the fence.
Okay.
And he's standing behind his truck. So he's got his truck as cover.
Yeah. He's behind cover. And it was smart of you to do the zigzag because it makes you a harder target. Makes him have to refocus on you every time. And it gives you an opportunity to evaluate whether or not he's de-escalating or continuing to escalate, which he was continuing to escalate despite being repeatedly told you were a federal law enforcement officer, right?
Right.
Okay, so now he's behind cover. Now that's like an oh shit moment.
Yeah. And I told myself as he was coming around the last time, I'm at the point of no return. If he pulls his gun on me, if he points it at me again, I'm pulling my gun to shoot.
Okay.
If he makes a threatening statement or threatens to kill me, I'm pulling my gun to shoot.
Yep.
So, but he comes around the last time where he's behind cover, and but he doesn't put his gun on me that time. And I still have my badge out, but it's painfully obvious at this point in time. My hat, badge, my creds are out, and I'm yelling at him at this point. I'm like, I'm a federal agent. You cannot put your gun on me. What are you doing?
Right.
Like, we've been on the property before. You know what this is about. So I put my credentials away. I'm feeling a little bit like I'm more in control of the situation at this point, but I'm kind of rifling into him. Like, what are you doing pointing a gun at a federal agent?
Right.
He's going on and on and on about, we're sick and tired of you guys coming out here. We're tired of you being on a property. We're tired of being under investigation. I was like, well, then don't break the law. You know, simple as that, you know, comply to the cease and desist order. I said, I see what you guys are doing here. You guys are, you know, disking the top soil. You guys are getting ready to deep rip, you know? So he starts getting worked up. I'm kind of digging into him about, you know, felony to pull a gun on a federal agent.
Yeah. It's just, once you've identified yourself as a federal agent, he continues to point a gun at you. That's a crime.
Right. So one thing that happened that I wasn't even really thinking about, but I was moving closer to the fence. I wasn't even paying attention to this. Apparently he was mimicking my behavior, and I wasn't paying attention to that either.
Interesting.
But when the incident really happened, when everything kind of came to a head, he was standing right at his truck. So at this point, he's got both hands on his gun, and he's standing right at his wheel well. And I'm giving him the knife hand. I certainly was going drill sergeant on him at that point.
I bet you were.
Going, look, I mean, I know I had my drill sergeant voice out going, look, you can't point a gun at a, you know, federal agent.
Right.
And he lost it. He snapped. And, you know, of course, the way they made it sound in court later, he made it sound like he's an innocent victim, but he snapped and he said, I don't care. He goes, I'm going to fucking kill you.
Whoa.
And he lifted his gun up. He was going to shoot. He lifted his gun up and it hit the wheel well.
Oh my God.
So with the statement of him saying he was going to effing kill me and him bringing his gun up, but I don't think he realized how close he was to his truck.
Yeah.
And his gun hit the wheel well.
Did
and
you,
right then.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, with his combined statement and with him raising his gun up, at that moment in time, I knew the fight was on. And yeah. I broke leather and I was pulling my gun to shoot.
Yeah. So this is the first time you drew your weapon. You were very disciplined in not drawing your weapon up to this point. So you draw your weapon at this point.
Right. I mean, it had crossed my threshold.
Yeah.
He had, not only did he make a statement that he was going to kill me, he was making a movement to bring his gun up.
Yeah.
And so I was drawn down. I was going to return. I was going to shoot before he did.
Yeah.
It was lucky for me that he was mimicking my move. I didn't even realize I had gotten that close to the fence, but I guess he had mimicked my movements of kind of edging closer to his truck as well.
Ah.
And when his gun, you know, so hearing him say he was going to kill me and then hearing his gun hit the wheel well, and then he saw me drawing my gun. I mean, it all happened in a split second. He knew I had him. He knew I had the advantage at that point. I had never seen a fat man drop so quick. He dropped like a sack of potatoes because he knew I had the drop on him.
Right.
And you talk about the importance of training. Because my first instinct was I have to drop to the ground and shoot underneath the truck.
Right. Which they train us to do. Yeah.
Yeah. And the first thought that came to my mind was a training incident that we had at the National Conservation Training Center. where we went to the Department of Homeland Security facility, where was Rick Branzell in a white van, where you walk up onto the van and he's holding a gun. And as soon as you make contact with him, he gets out of the van, and really you're supposed to drop underneath the van and shoot at his ankles.
Yep.
And that underscores the importance of training, because that's the first thing that came to my mind was the only shot I have at this point is underneath the vehicle.
Yeah.
And so that builds that Rolodex of what do I have in the Rolodex of training or scenarios in my head of anything that mimics this. And that was the first thing that came to my mind. So I hit the ground to shoot and engage underneath the vehicle.
Mm.
I had maybe an inch because the way the road and the vehicle was, I could see them, but I was afraid of wasting shots, trying to waste shooting and trying to get it in that small of a,
yeah, that'd be a tough shot, even at a closer range. Right. So how did you, but you didn't end up shooting. So how did it de-escalate?
Well, so I popped up and I thought, okay, I'm going to rush around the side and then try to ambush him on the other side of the truck. Right then, another truck drove up. And I'm thinking, then I started to get a little scared.
Yeah, you're outnumbered potentially.
Now I'm outnumbered. And I don't know who it is.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if this person is going to jump out with a rifle or something that outpowers me. So the first thing I thought of is, okay, I need to create distance at this point, not knowing what's about to happen. So I didn't put my gun up, but I start to retreat along the fence line, you know, still facing them. And I see another rotund guy who turned out to be the main subject come out in between the vehicles, and he's wearing a big like jean duster coat. He's got like a big jean shirt. This guy's like 400 bills. I mean, he's a big guy.
Okay.
He's covering his waistline. There's no weapons accessible to hands. None. Okay. So at that moment, the main guy I was dealing with who had threatened my life jumps in the middle truck now, because there's my truck, the subject's truck, and then the truck that drove up.
Right.
So the guy that pulled the gun on me jumps in his truck and peels away.
Took off. Okay.
So that threat's gone. So now it's just me and the other guy.
Yeah, who you don't know.
Oh, I don't know. Yeah. But I don't see any weapons though either.
Right.
So I approach him, gun at my side. This guy's screaming at me, top of his lungs. And he didn't see that I had my gun out at that moment in time. But I was like, hey, I go, who are you? And he said, I'm Ken Watkins. I said, you're the main landowner? And he goes, yeah. And I go, who is that? And he goes, that was my brother, Andrew. I said, okay. And he goes, you're the fed with Fish and Wildlife. And I said, yeah. And he goes, you get the hell off my property. He's just screaming at me.
Yeah.
And I said, Ken, I said, can you calm down for a second? And he's like, no. And he's still screaming at me. I finally said, Ken, I go, is any investigation worth your brother's life?
Yeah.
I put him on his heels. And he goes, what? I go, is any investigation, regardless if you think it were right or wrong, worth your brother's life? And he's like, well, no. And I said, well, okay. I go, I was about a fraction of a second from killing your brother. I go, because he pulled a gun on me and said he was going to kill me. And I go, does that put things in perspective for you here?
Oh.
Ken amped way down.
Good.
And he goes, no, he goes, that's not worth my brother's life. And I go, then let's take a shot of common sense here and let's deal with this problem right now. I go, because your brother just about tried to kill me and I was just about ready to kill your brother.
And Sean, this story makes me tense all over. I remember when it happened, and it still keeps me up at night if I think about it while I'm trying to fall asleep.
Yeah, it was intense. It was really intense.
Was Andrew charged with threatening you?
Eventually, yeah. It took some time to get there. You know, the SAC at the time, Jill Birchall, she wrote a letter on my behalf, and you know, you wrote a letter on my behalf. Thank you for that, Ed. Mm-hmm. Which is really unfortunate, because, and I know you had mentioned this in your letter, that this was FBI, if this was ATF,
yeah,
you know, this would not even be a question if you were charged under 18 USC 111 yeah. for assault on a federal officer.
Yeah. So what happened, Sean, was they charged him, but they were going to drop it down to a misdemeanor. And that just sent me through the roof, man.
Well, one of the things that had them, the U.S. Attorney's Office, kind of worked up was their counsel. And again, this guy's very politically connected. Yeah. William Portnova, who was their counsel that they had brought on, was formerly the chief of violent crimes.
Right.
For the Eastern District of California. So formerly all their supervisors.
Right.
And that had them a little bit anxious, because he was a taskmaster, and they were a little bit scared of him.
The U.S. attorneys were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, and even Richard Bender, Dick Bender, who is now the chief of, you know, violent crimes, that used to be Dick's former boss, and Dick was a little scared of him, I think.
And it was that guy that was recommending the lesser charges against Watkins, right?
Well, yeah, it was Richard that wanted the lesser charges.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until it was essentially less than an infraction.
Yeah.
What they wanted to offer him.
Right.
And when Portnova declined and said, no, we don't accept that, that infuriated the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Yeah.
And it was only because of, really only because of that incident, that they decided to really throw the book at him.
Oh, okay.
So
he did end up getting charged with a felony eventually.
They charged him with 18 USC 111.
Yeah, which is threatening a federal officer, yeah.
Right, in the course of his duties, yeah.
Yeah.
Or her duties, yeah. And sadly, because of the Bundy incident in Nevada.
Right.
And this is the precursor to the Malheur refuge incident. This is what led to that event, essentially. But the incident in Nevada that took place with the standoff there, oddly enough, had both the prosecution and the defense afraid to take this to trial.
Interesting. Yeah.
They were afraid of the court of public opinion, both sides equally. The defense and the prosecution were both equally afraid of how this would play out in the court of public opinion. And sadly, the defense's side kept changing. They kept changing their story.
Yeah.
The prosecution side never wavered once on.
He did get convicted.
He did get convicted. He ended up getting 4 years supervised probation, 4 years home confinement, a $10,000 fine. And he had all of his weapons confiscated during his probation.
You know, this is a good illustration of the hostility that exists against federal officers in many Western states. And a lot of these people think they can just threaten and bully federal officers. And you can't. It's a violation of federal law to threaten the life of a federal officer. So
it is.
You know, this case to me shows incredible restraint on your part. You know, you didn't talk about it in this part, but you're a U.S. Army vet. You have combat experience. It took amazing restraint for you not to shoot this person. And I think about it, you know, how would I have reacted? And I don't know, honestly. I don't know if I would have had, you know, if I would have been as brave as you or whether I would have shot the guy. I don't know. But it's a scary situation, and it could happen to any federal agent, whether you're FBI or Fish and Wildlife Service, and it can happen on the most routine investigation ever. This is not the kind of situation you'd go out on and think you're about to get in a gun battle with somebody, right?
Yeah.
So kudos to you for the way you handled it, Sean. It's a scary situation. You handled it well. The prosecutor ultimately did the right thing. So good job on that. Yeah. There's more to tell on this story, but it, you know, this is a short, and I just wanted to give you an opportunity to tell that story so other agents would hear it, other officers would hear it, and the public would know that this is what Fish and Wildlife Service agents face every time they go out in the field. So thank you, Sean. I appreciate you doing this short for us. It's always good to see you. Ed. Thanks for being on the show.
Yeah. Always a pleasure, Ed. Appreciate it.
All right. We'll see you next time. Nature Secret Service is written and produced by me, Ed Newcomer, and is co-produced by the DHTV team here at California State University, Dominguez Hills. Follow us on social media and connect with us online at naturesecretservice.com.